Graham's been a pastor, but currently Graham is a clinical psychologist with Flourish. And we thought there'd be no better person to come and share his expertise and his insights on family as we embark on looking into this core tenet of family together. So can you give Graham a really big hand as he comes and shares with us this morning? Thank you, mate.
Thanks so much. I do remember that. And I remember thinking, oh man, if I look scared now, I'm going to look really... So I tried to hide it well. Lovely to be back with you this morning. And it's always great to wake up and think, get to stand in front of a whole bunch of people and speak and then look in the mirror and see I've got a big pimple forming. So if you need to look away because I'm hideous, I understand. Look, as a part of the series on your core tenets as a church, I've been asked to speak about family from my perspective as a clinical psychologist and pastor. And I'm stoked to hear that equipping families is a key purpose at Good Life. It's so good. So looking forward to unpacking that a little this morning. My background in theological studies was largely around Israelite culture and that illustrates heaps of cool stuff about family. And my practice as a psychologist is often with children and family issues. So being able to play in both sandpits this morning is going to be fun. Our focus will be on church as an extended family, a type of extended family that can be extremely protective for children who lack it. So our applications this morning are going to be around children and our responsibility to those under our care. And I have a family myself, married 29 years with two boys. So I know anyone here with kids who got here this morning without threatening to leave at least one of them on the side of the road, well done. That's good. I was a pastor for 21 years just to give me an excuse to get out of the house on Sunday mornings. Sole reason. No, not at all. One of my sons is here, so I'll pretend I'm joking. But digging into family practices of ancient Israel, some customs make you thankful we live in the era we do, and others make you realise that advancements don't necessarily mean improvements. Living in increasingly smaller families and bigger houses has led to loneliness far more than happiness. A close family is so protective for mental health. And I'm not necessarily talking about the nuclear family either, the idea of children under the care of two parents, which we often see as the ideal. That's actually a fairly recent model. I'm talking about something far older and wiser. Families in the ancient Near East were comprised of far more than two adults. Most children were raised in a community of up to 50 or even more sometimes, many related, but not all. In fact, excavations of houses show that they were just added onto to accommodate more family. Sounds like a nightmare. But a groom would say to a bride-to-be that in my father's house there are many rooms and I'm going to go and add one, which you might recognise as an idea that Jesus picked up on to picture heaven as this community of extended family. So in the West, that's been the norm for most of history until recent times. As recent as the 1500s, the average European family group was roughly 20. By the mid-1800s, this had become 10. By 1960, it was down to 5. As we entered the 2000s, the average Western family was less than 4. And now up to a third of people live alone. And just because there's a correlation between this decreasing connectedness and increasing trauma doesn't mean it's a causation, but I certainly see many cases where it is. Humans need other humans. We're social creatures. We desperately need communities to provide this. And I know churches haven't always done a cracking job at that to prevent trauma. In fact, they've sometimes been the source of trauma. But done right, in an increasingly individualistic society, there aren't many other, sometimes any other multi-age communities other than churches to meet that need, that connection to an extended family. Collectively, you have the opportunity to provide the support and the safety that an extended family can give to those who lack support and safety. I deal daily with the fallout of this lack, and I see daily how a child's relationship with other people, especially safe and predictable adults, and that's a two key words there, safe and predictable. I see how that allows them to face stress and recover from it in ways that children without safe and predictable relationships often won't. The best protection against trauma and the best recovery from it is relationship, particularly the type that extended family, such as this community, can provide. And I want to suggest that the brain shows us why that is. So before we unpack some theological lessons about family development from the Bible, I want to unpack some psychological lessons from brain development, partly because I'm a bit nerdy, but mostly because when we better understand the biology of what goes wrong, we can better see the extended family of church, the role that they can fill to make things right. So stick with me for a moment, because this brain stuff will lead to the Bible stuff. If we start at the beginning, when the brain first forms, we see that it develops from the bottom up and from the inside out, okay? Starting with the brain stem, which develops during pregnancy and regulates vitals like heartbeat and blood pressure. The next layer up regulates appetite and motor control, and it also forms during pregnancy. And then the limbic system, the next layer, matures during childhood and controls emotion and memory. And then the final outer layer, the cortex, directs the ability to reason and problem solve and converse, and it grows from childhood through to early adulthood. And all of these parts work together for essentially one purpose: to keep you alive. Survival. Your brain as an organ is not particularly interested in your happiness, I'm sorry to say. It's interested in your safety. And so its stress system, which flows throughout these four regions from the bottom up, is constantly looking for what could go wrong and triggering particular responses in your body to protect you when it detects things going wrong. The brain stem causes the heartbeat to speed up, and the diencephalon causes the muscles to get ready for fight or flight. And then the limbic system activates fear, and all of this is before the top region can even decide whether fear is even necessary, or whether this alarm going off in your head like a smoke alarm is just from burnt toast and not a real house fire, yeah? And since most of this fear response relates to relationships, our brain is very attuned to facial expressions and tone of voice and the mood of those around us. And that's why family is going to be very important, for better or worse, as a child grows. Now, as a child grows, each brain region develops healthily when exposed to safe and repetitive patterned routine. Predictability. For example, working from the bottom up, the rhythmic patterned heartbeat of a mother during pregnancy and the predictable cycles of her breathing and her sleep organizes the baby's brainstem to set a rhythmic heartbeat. Music and movement, both of which are rhythmic and patterned, and pre-language, they help develop the regulatory system in the next level up. And when music and rhythm is lacking, it can lead to struggles with sleep and coordination complications as the child grows. The next layer, rhythmic rocking, right, and holding a child close to feel your patterned breathing teaches their limbic system to self-soothe. Young children, by the way, they need adults to they're fully dependent on you adults to lower their stress, because their stress response system is not even formed yet. This is why to calm a worried or an angry child, we need to first be calm ourselves. Then moving to that outer region, and the older ages, it's still repetitive patterned input that helps us develop. Even stress that's applied in moderate patterned doses strengthens resilience, okay? In much the same way that weights applied in moderate patterned doses will strengthen muscles, and weight that's too much will cause damage, just as stress that's too much or excessive will cause damage. So in short, sum this idea up. Children's brains are molded for the better by what they're repeatedly exposed to at the right stages of development, and in moderate and predictable doses. And they're molded for the worse by what they're exposed to unpredictably and excessively by others. So this ancient machine in our head, everyone's head here, was designed to run on that social operating system. Now, to shift from the survival, what do we call the survival formula of the ancient brain to an ancient formula for modern families, we could say that safety, mental and physical, plus predictability, plus the resources to cope, if you've got the absence of either of those first two, equals survival. That's how you survive and thrive, yeah? And therefore, the reverse is also true. When life, if we bring up the next slide, when life is unsafe or unpredictable and you have no or low resources to cope, you experience trauma. And I suspect that a number of those nods are coming from lived experience, yeah, of that formula. Lack of safety, mental and physical, plus unpredictability, plus low or no resources to cope, equals trauma. And when you're faced with that equation, the brain has a bottom-up response. Okay, it almost shuts down that top level, doesn't it? So that your lower survival levels can increase your heart rate and blood pressure and get you ready to fight or to run, which is all good and well if you need to, but it's not a system that was designed to run all the time. Just side note, actually, this explains why a toddler and a 15-year-old who faced the same type of trauma will be left with very different complications, right? Because of the brain region that was developing at the time that equation struck, right? So the toddler may be left with motor dysfunction because that was the part of the brain in development. Whereas a teenager may struggle with more complex emotions about the trauma because it was the more complex part of their brain that was in development when it happened. Make sense? Yeah. So, why are we talking about this here in a church in a series about families? Well, this is what shifts us from the Bible, from the brain to the Bible. So, Old Testament or Hebrew culture valued child development so much they had 7 different words for these stages. Yaled meant newborn, Yanak meant suckling, Alel was one who moves from milk to bread, Gamul was a 2-year-old, Alem was the word for one becoming stronger, Na'ah was one who shakes himself free, and I love that word because it even sounds like Na'ah, and Bakur means a growing or warrior. And these were all words for between birth and age 5, which we call the formative years because it's when the brain is forming most rapidly. So Hebrew teaching also says that the 2 biggest gifts from God were these children and the scriptures. And so the highest calling was to teach the latter to the former. And this wasn't a calling just for immediate family, but a calling for the broader extended family of a faith community, this broader family. When it comes to this calling, the undisputed central text was Deuteronomy 11, 18 to 21, which reads, "Fix these words of mine in your hearts and minds, bind them on your foreheads, teach them to your children, talking about them when you sit at home, when you walk along the road, when you lie down, when you get up, write them on the door frames of your houses and on your gates, so that your days and the days of your children may be many. Now, if we map this central Hebrew text onto that formula, we see verse 18, hearts and minds is talking physical and mental safety. Verse 19, when you're home, when you're on the road, when you lie down, when you get up, is talking about predictable, patterned input. Verse 20, write the scriptures down, bind them to your foreheads, is talking about having the resources to cope. And verse 21, so that your days and the days of your children may be many, is talking about survival. In other words, the core ingredients that a healthy brain needs to develop were the very ingredients that a faith community is called to teach to children. That's cool, hey? Now, by the way, that passage is not some guarantee for a long life. Bad stuff happens, and when it does, it's not a family's failing, because this text is a general principle to guide, not some magic spell to protect us, right? And that scripture that the passage is talking about were the first five books of the Bible, because that's all that was written at the time of this passage. And the first five books, called the Torah, were where most Jewish traditions or rituals were found. All of their feasts, all of their festivals, all of which were repeated over and over, week after week or year after year, in exactly the same way, and still are 5,000 years later. It bred a repetition or a predictability into the children's lives, particularly for those first 5 years, but then throughout their life as well. From birth to that first state of independence when children go, nuh-uh. The Torah is what identified them as a community. And it gave them safety and it helped them to survive longer than almost any other culture. So, what does all of this mean for this faith community, for Good Life? How do we blend these neurological observations, right, and biblical implications into some practical applications? So, three, to keep it childlike, ABC suggestions from that Bible-based model that we can map onto this brain-based formula. First, regarding safety, there's no question you need to provide a safe environment for kids here, okay? That's a given. But to build resilience in kids, safety also needs some risk. Remember, stress applied in moderate pattern doses builds muscle. Just as weights applied in, builds resilience, just as weights applied in moderate pattern doses build muscle, strengthens it. When our playgrounds and our parenting and our programs are risk-free, bubble-wrapped in the name of safety, we deny the children to learn from consequences, which ironically makes them less safe. Brains learn from what they repeatedly do, including repeatedly facing risks and making mistakes and failing. So let them do that. Provide opportunity to fail. Israel didn't bubble wrap their children. Adolescents actually took on adult roles. Now, it's true that the decision-making region of the brain, which is that top area, and I've purposely shaved my head just so I could visualize it for you. no. That's parenting. It's true that decision-making region, it's not. Decision-making region of the brain doesn't finish wiring until like mid-20s, actually, especially for males, really. But this happens through trial and error. So allow risk. Allow trial and error. Age appropriately, of course. Let kids be silly and playful and have short attention spans, because that's what their brains are. Don't give too much responsibility too soon. But don't give too little either. Learn from Deuteronomy. Get teens involved in leadership, in mentoring, in standing up front here and being involved in speaking and let them make mistakes. Avoid zero tolerance policies wherever possible. They need to know that it's safe to mess up. And keep your community age varied. Older adults, get involved in Boost, in Friday Evening Kids Club. Look around and interact with age groups other than your own. Share your story with them and listen to their stories yourself. Second, regarding predictability, learn from Israel and build rituals into your families, your church, your year. In the brain, rituals are behaviors that wear a neural pathway, making the same behavior more likely to follow. In the Bible, rituals were repeated habits, some every 7 days, some every year, to teach people something about God, usually that he can be trusted when life cannot. And this is repeated over and over because we need to learn it over and over because we need forgiveness over and over, which he keeps providing over and over. It's this patterned repeating idea, the predictability and the permanence and the over and overness of a church family and community. I loved what you shared about your family growing up here. Just that gives children something that they can count on. And I cannot stress enough the importance of that for brain development. A mind thrives when it knows what's coming next, and a mind's stress response system remains switched on when it doesn't know what's coming next. So let your community be a constant for your children. There are enough unknowns in this world. So a third application regarding the need for resources is to communicate the scriptures to your children. Teach truth. This chapter says to tie them on your hands and bind them on your foreheads and write them on your door frames of your houses and your gates. And anyone who's been to Israel sees how literally that's taken there. But the general principle is to resource our children with truth, with the capacity to cope when life is less safe and less predictable, because the less resources people have to tolerate uncertainty, the more anxious and traumatized they become. And since we can't always decrease life's uncertainties, we have to increase our tolerance for them. And that's something the scriptures help us do. When we not only get into the scriptures, but let the scriptures get into us and become a faith community. Like the Israelites were, their community was based on the Torah. So, A, B, C. Allow risk, build rituals, communicate scriptural truth. That formula, drawn from that most ancient text on family development, it maps directly onto the most modern research about what it takes to combat trauma in kids. Trauma that affects brain development and is best prevented through extended family development. To close, let me just read what a study of over 30,000 people's brains concluded. This is from Dr. Bruce Perry, whose research heavily influenced some of this content this morning. He writes, "A child with a strong social network of connectedness is at far less risk from potentially traumatic experience than a child with such support. Having a strong social network with many high-quality relational interactions over time predicts good mental health better than traumatic experiences predict poor mental health. Consequently, if you want to predict someone's mental health based on their childhood experiences, looking at positive social factors, at their connectedness to a broader family, okay, that will tell you more than focusing exclusively on trauma." That's really cool. Conclusion of 30,000 people's brains and their social environment. So when it comes to the sort of extended family good life is offering, realize that the opposite of a good life is not a bad life, it's a disconnected life. Because the connection that you offer teaches kids that people matter, that they matter, and there is nothing more important for children than that. Thanks.